The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Thursday. That means it's time for Dr. Henry Nyman, first hour tonight. We're going to talk about this influenza thing. I believe it is running pretty much rampant in 49, if not all 50 states by now. A number of people have died. Of course, that happens every time there's a bad flu outbreak. People just don't remember it until it happens. Henry, how are you? And how bad is this particular outbreak? Is it a pandemic or is it an epidemic? What are we?
Well, it's kind of still an epidemic. It's seasonal flu. The culprit in this season, at least right now, is the H3N2, and the H3N2 has a tendency to produce a more severe season. It's because part of it just has to do with the population and who is exposed to what. You know, if you recall, H3N2 kind of came on the scene in the 1968 pandemic. Right. It was the Hong Kong flu. Right. And so older people who basically kind of grew up when just H1N1 was circulating didn't really get exposure to this when they were kind of developing their immunity in their formative years. And so they're particularly susceptible to the virus. And it's kind of the same thing. The very young are also susceptible to it. And as a result, the number of hospitalizations tend to be significantly higher when this virus is dominant. And this season, it seems to be a fairly virulent version that isn't working all that well for the vaccines. And so that kind of makes things even more
difficult. Right, right. So just briefly, as a quick aside, Henry, would it be fair to say that vaccines kind of, why bother this year? I mean, you're not going to miss much by not taking it, are you, really?
Well, I was really going to focus on that because that was kind of one of the comments in the report. The CDC came out with a conference call last Friday and to kind of describe the situation. Mm-hmm. They noted that the virus was widespread in all 50 states, and it's very unusual that you will get that much, you know, coverage that frequently the peak of the season, it could be widespread, but there's usually a few states that, you know, it hasn't gotten to its peak level yet, or it's already past the peak. And in this case, last week, it was really widespread in all 50 states. And so they held this teleconference to kind of give an update. And they did touch on the vaccine aspect of it. And part of the reason I'm bringing this up, if you recall last month, I had said I had gone and gotten my flu vaccine and ended up getting the version that was grown in mammalian cells. And the reason was really because of how the virus is prepared usually.
Uh-huh.
And how it affects how well the vaccine will work. The vaccine was especially poor in Australia. Last season, Australia, basically has their flu season in the southern hemisphere. So they have their flu season, over our summer. And they were only getting about a 10% response rate to the vaccine. It's a little bit higher in the northern hemisphere. This season, it's up to about 30%. But 30% is still pretty low. It usually is closer to 50%. And they actually cited the difference between the virus that's grown in mammalian cells and the virus that's grown in eggs. And, I had mentioned this before. There was a paper that had come out in PNAS, and they noted that at this one particular immunogenic site on the H3, the virus that's normally circulating in the wild has a glycosylation site. So it's basically a sequence of amino acids. It's got an N, and then it can have any amino acids, and then it's got an S or a T. And as a result, there's a sugar that's placed on that N, and that that's an attractive site for the immune system. So the virus that's circulating, you can develop immunity by targeting that sugar that's put on the surface.
So it has a sweet tooth.
Hemagglutinin. It's got a sweet, sugar coated, so to speak, and so that's an attractive target. And unfortunately, when they take the virus, they basically isolate a reassortant that's got the H and the N that represents the target for this season. And they put it on this background from a virus that was actually isolated in Puerto Rico back in, I think, 1938. So that's kind of the standard backbone. And then the pharmaceuticals like to grow the virus in eggs. They can get, with this combination in particular, they've got a lot of experience, putting the H and N of interest on this backbone and growing it in eggs, and they can get very high yields. So they can get a lot of virus going that route. And, they're basically set up to do it. They get pathogen-free eggs that they use, and they've got these giant rooms.
Always a good start. Pathogen-free eggs.
Crates. And they basically inject the virus in the egg, and the virus grows. Unfortunately, in this particular case, when they inject the virus into the eggs, that actually selects for a virus that doesn't have the glycosylation site. And so the virus that's an isolator from the eggs and uh-huh. killed and put into the vaccine is missing that sugar coating, that sugar residue, which is this attractive immunogenic site. And so when you get the vaccine, the sugar's not there, and you don't really make antibodies to the sugar because it isn't there. And therefore, the immune response that is elicited from that vaccination is not all that effective against the virus in circulation because the virus has got that glycosylation site and that sugar residue put on. So in the report, in the teleconference that they had last Friday, it was really in the question and answer session, and one of the reporters basically said, there's issues with the vaccine not really working all that well this year, and you got a lot of it. They said they had like 151 million doses, so there was plenty of vaccine available, but it really wasn't working that well, and the hospitals are filling up, and they gave some of the numbers, and the age group slightly under the 50 to 64 age group had basically doubled in hospitalizations in the last week. And so, there were a lot of issues with the hospitalizations. I don't know if you actually heard there's a shortage of the, of the bags.
IV bags, yeah.
And basically that was because they make them in Puerto Rico and they couldn't really, because of the hurricane and no electricity, they couldn't really keep their production levels up. And the smaller bags they ran out of, and they started using the bigger bags as a substitute. And the bigger bags are used to treat flu victims, and so using the bigger bags because of the shortage of the smaller bags created a shortage of the bigger bags. And so it's an issue that they have, hospitals are filling up because of the flu season, and a part of it is driven by, this vaccine really not working that well.
Let me ask you a question about if people hurry into the hospital when they're sick, they're all shook up, and they're, how long do they stay? A week?
Well,
I mean, they're really taking up beds. They must stay a while.
Well, some of them stay there until they get wheeled out because they don't survive. So they can be, it kind of depends on how bad a shape they're in. Especially you get older patients that go in there, and a severe case of the flu can kind of put them over the edge where they actually,
do they end up with pneumonia? They end up with pneumonia, Henry?
Right. They get pneumonia, and then they get on a ventilator, and then they basically, are stuck in that at that level until they can lungs can basically recover, and some of the older patients they don't, and so they can be in there for several weeks, and some of them recover and others don't, so the death rate goes up as a result of this, and the hospitals fill up, and then the IV bag shortage, doesn't help. And so they actually, they mentioned that, I had said that I got the vaccine that was grown in the mammalian cells, MDCK, their canine kidney cells. And they, and in this report, they actually described them. They say you really have two choices. One of them is a recombinant vaccine, so they actually grow the virus the bacteria that's got the envelope expressed there. So then they make the protein, they isolate the protein as a recombinant protein, and since they don't have to grow that in eggs, it does have the glycosylation site on there. And that vaccine is actually called FluBlock. And then they mentioned the other one, which is the one that I actually had, which is the one that's grown in mammalian cells. And that's called FluCell. And so they actually gave the names of the vaccines. And Apparently, there's not a shortage. I think part of the reason there's not a shortage is since it's well into the flu season right now, and you know, a lot of people that got vaccinated, you know, got vaccinated back in September and October, and that's really the best time to get vaccinated. But because of the flu season so bad, more people have been, you know, gotten vaccines.
Well, let me, if I might, introduce this and ask about our hospital staff and first responders and other medical personnel who are exposed to this. I mean, they're in the hospital. They got patients in the hospital, lots of them. It says in this story, flu can be spread just by breathing. Coughing and sneezing not required with this year's strain. Researchers at University of Maryland found infectious virus in the air that flu patients exhaled. The air was particularly full of virus in the first few days of symptoms. So they're shedding enormous amounts just in exhalation. Right. Now, that can be pretty bad. I mean, are all the hospital employees now wearing masks? I would think N95 would be mandatory. They're going to get sick just breathing.
Well, they usually do not do mandate that the hospital staff actually is vaccinated. So that's one of the ways that they
Yeah, but the vaccine missed this year. So
Yeah. Well, it's exactly what kind of protective gear they have. I'm not sure. I mean, the fact that the flu can transmit through the air really isn't new. I mean, if you recall, sometimes we go into detail on especially the avian flu and how it becomes more mammalian, and that really has to do with the polymerase of PB2, and there's a big difference between the avian version and the mammalian version at the position 627.
Well, the interesting part about this is they're saying in the beginning stage of being infected with the influenza virus, you are shedding so many viruses that you don't have to cough or hack or sneeze to really present a threat. All you have to do is exhale. Now, isn't that a little bit unusual?
I mean, it might have to do with, you know, how seriously they're measuring it, and it may have to do with a higher viral load and a higher titer.
That's what it sounds like.
Like I said, the polymerase for mammalian has got a K there, and that the optimal temperature is like 33 degrees centigrade, which is relatively close to body temperature is 37, but in the nose it's going to be exposed to the air. Uh-huh. It's going to be a little bit low.
Well, the author of this article,
and the virus does grow well at that temperature, and that's part of the reason they call it seasonal flu, that it grows quickest when it's cold, and so it is contagious because it grows best in the upper respiratory tract where it's a little bit cooler adapted to.
Well, this is interesting.
Output there.
Let me read a little bit more of this, Henry. I want to get your comment. This is a big story. It's in the Daily Mail. Lead author Dr. Donald Milton said he urges anyone to stay home if they have a fever, cough, sore throat, or just feel lousy. And he goes on to say, influenza comes on hard and fast, and you are probably infectious right away, right then. I would like people in my workplace who are coming down with the flu to please go home and not infect me. Based on previous studies, Dr. Milton said, the virus lingers hours in the air, hours. So I've not read this quite this graphically before.
Well, that is why they, you know, urge you not to go to work and tell kids to go home. And, they basically, they got guidelines. And, I mean, they usually have to have a bit of a fever. I think it's 100.4 in the symptoms. And it is contagious. And that is the reason that, so many people on a bad flu season end up getting sick. And that's the reason there's always concern about a flu pandemic, because essentially the virus you know, does transmit through the air, and it's pretty easy to transmit the flu, and you know, a lot of that transmission is really going to be dependent upon what the viral load is, and you know, basically, if the virus seems to be able to grow a little bit better because, you know, potentially the vaccine doesn't work as well or it's just adapted well enough so that it's not, it can evade the immune system and it can, you know, it's always a battle between how well the host is doing, how well the virus is doing, and the virus is able to do a little better than usual. There's more virus there and all of these things, whether it's breathing or sneezing or coughing, and that puts virus into the air.
Here's one little bit more. They had a group of test subjects. Each person gave nasal swabs, 218 samples of exhaled breathing and samples of coughing and samples of sneezing. They then cultured the air in the contained room. Half of the samples had detectable viral flu in them, suggesting that coughing is not the only way to spread this particular, sometimes deadly flu. So that's, to me, interesting. I don't remember reading that quite like this.
Well, like I said, I think a lot of this really comes down to how hard you want to look. I mean, we used to do experiments that, back when I was in high school, they would just take Petri dishes and, you know, uncover them and put them out on the tabletop. And then you basically come back 24 hours later and you see how many microorganisms are floating around in the air and settle down, and they have the right medium in this case. They grow. And and so you're really battling, you know, viruses and bacteria all the time. And it's when you start losing the battle that you end up getting these symptoms. And that's kind of the story. So yeah, like I said, I think part of that really has to do with how hard you look. And you know, if you're looking to find virus in the air, and you've got a good system for getting the virus to grow, if it's there, then you find out that it in fact is in the air.
Well, this one seemed, the onset seems to be apparently very quick. A very quick gestation
stage. Well, that's one of the characteristics of the flu. It's got a relatively slow, quick incubation, a short incubation period. And so you can develop symptoms within a day or two. And that's not that unusual. Sometimes it takes a little longer. And again, this is all... you know, dose related, that the time it takes you to develop symptoms is due in part to how big of a viral load you're exposed to and how well the virus grows regarding either how well it copies itself or how well you fight it. And so the virus flu is a type of disease that, it could have a pretty short incubation period because the virus does have the ability to grow that quickly.
I started to get it about 3 weeks ago, and it was that kind that, in my case, you get that extremely sore throat in an area on one side or the other, and then, it moves around. But I had a very sore throat on one side, maybe about the size of a dime. It felt like a silver dollar, but really, it hurt. It was sore. And I knew I was getting something substantial. And then I started to get a little headachy. And fortunately, I've got this Allicin C, which is the extremely concentrated form of the allicin from garlic, which is an historic fighter of bacteria and viruses. And I was able to get on top of it. I fought it immediately to a stop. And within 2 days, I was fine. I beat it. And I really do praise the Allicin C for it. And I know it may sound a little commercial, but it works. And if you are interested, it's on the homepage at Rents, Allicin C. I would urge all of you to get it and at least have it in the medicine cabinet so when you have the onset of symptoms, you can pounce with this right away. I took four a day in the morning, four in the afternoon, four in the evening, first couple days, four, 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 four. And each capsule Henry, has the equivalent of 35 cloves worth of allicin in each capsule. No odor. The scientist who's very brilliant who put this together stabilized it. He's got it in his capsules. So I would just suggest that as a possible option.
Well, just in general, almost whatever you're going to use to treat, again, it really has to do with the dose, the viral load, and generally the earlier you start treating, the better. There's just less virus.
Okay, very good. Hold on, Henry. I got to pause. We'll come right back with Dr. Henry Nyman talking about our flu season issues. And I hope most of you are well and didn't get it. Not fun stuff. Back in a minute. Hold on. Flu season, indeed. Be careful. I've only seen one person out among them with a mask on to protect himself. There should be more people doing that. In Japan, if you're ill and you're out, you wear a mask. It's a matter of public decorum and compassion for your fellow human being. And if you're not sick, a lot of people use those as a preventive. Do you see many, Henry, when you're out?
No, I just... I saw in a doctor's office, I had a big sign up that said, if you're coughing or sneezing, put a mask on. But
or in this case, breathing.
As far as out and about,
nobody seems to do it.
It's more common in Asia. And I remember the pictures when the SARS outbreak in China, that everybody's wearing a mask.
Well, when you were over there at that conference, did you see many then at that time? There may not have been much going on, but they seemed
routine. Everybody was coughing, but there weren't masks. I mean, it was, I don't know. I was in Beijing, so I think it might have just been the pollution. But
the air. Boy, is the air bad.
I did notice the number of people that were coughing was just remarkable that everybody was. And I really didn't see much in the way of masks. But, I was a little concerned back then. So I was worried. And I knew there was some H5N1 circulating there. And I was kind of attuned to the coughing, but once I got to the hotel, I took a little bit of Tamiflu before I went, and I just figured that there really wasn't as much once I was at the conference itself, and so I kind of stopped the prophylactic part. But in my case, it was a lot more on the coughing side than it was on the prevention side, and. Speaking of prevention, I basically want to kind of shift gears here for the second half. And actually, I did this little project using the personal DNA testing. And
23andMe?
I did end up using 23andMe to do it. I've been researching these kits for a while. Really focused on 23andMe and Ancestry, and ended up shifting over to 23andMe. They basically upgraded their version there in August. They went up to version 5, and that was dramatically different than version 4. I had started on version 4, and they a lot of the markers that they had in 4, they kicked out of the 5, and a lot of the ones that they had in 5, they didn't have in 4. It was so dramatic that the new version was not compatible with the earlier ones. There's some website will let you upload your raw DNA, and therefore you can see how it compared to other people that have used the other product, FPDNA, Family Tree, and MyHeritage DNA. Both offered that. They said if you had your DNA file from either Ancestry or 23andMe, you could upload it to their site, and then you can see who your DNA relatives were at either of those two sites. And the change in the version 5 was so dramatic that you couldn't upload it to these other sites.
What could cause such a huge change, Henry? Well, how could they come back at it so differently?
Well, it really has to do with results, and that's why I was going to go into a little bit more detail than I have in the past.
We got about, just so you know, we have about 15 minutes. Go ahead.
Right. So these kits essentially, they test about 600,000 markers, a little bit over 600,000, and there's different versions out there. And like I said, and beginning of last year, when I started using these, 23andMe had version 4. And version 4 had a lot in common with some of the other, like Ancestry, because they use earlier versions also. Most of these, I think actually all of these kits are made by a company called Illumina. So they make the chips and they do the various upgrades and part of the upgrading is just because they look, you know, every test doesn't perform the same. Some may give false positive, false negatives. And so they kind of tweak the system. And just so your listeners have a better idea, the only company that really has FDA approval really is 23andMe at this time. But the FDA approval is a little bit misleading. The FDA approval has to do with them submitting data and showing that they have, you know, a low false positive rate and a low false negative rate, but it's not at the approval letter level where it's approved for use in a clinical setting. And so there's they'd say they announced like 10 different tests that have got the FDA approval. So that says that the results you get is relatively reliable, but not at the level where they say you can substitute this for results at a clinical lab, which has a little bit more rigor as far as what it takes to have the approval. I think in the clinical labs, they actually have to show this in various controls and human cases. And in most instances, the clinical tests really are for active disease as opposed to these tests, which are looking at your predisposition.
Okay.
And so I kind of took this challenge that I kind of gave myself, which was to see if I could use the 23andMe data to accurately measure. The target I ended up using was it's one of the more well-known cancer markers. I ended up targeting BRCA1, which is BRCA stands for breast cancer. It's a fairly serious situation where the defect is a frame shift, so it pretty much kills the protein. The protein is involved with repairing mistakes that are made during recombination, so it's kind of right up my alley there. It's with recombination in humans. And sometimes there's these mistakes in both BRCA1 and BRCA2 with other proteins form complexes that basically clean that those errors up. And if the proteins aren't, the complex isn't working properly, you start accumulating these mutations and these errors, and then other proteins start not functioning properly, and you generally give rise to cancer. And a recent study showed that the signatures of having a defect in this repair is actually found in about 25% of human breast cancer. So it's a mechanism that that is pretty well used, and in some cases it's BRCA1 and BRCA2. Some cases it's some of the proteins associated with it, and some of them are from undiscovered proteins. They see the signature, they see the effect that the mutations are accumulating, but the known members of the complex are normal. And so exactly what in the cell is involved with that process is still a bit unknown. But I kind of took the challenge to see if I could really monitor BRCA1 in a family population where, you know, one member had been identified as being positive. And the challenge was to see whether I could use the 23andMe test to identify BRCA1 with a high degree of confidence in other family members, and actually use the family tree to trace back where the mutation originated and identify its origins, as well as who is at risk. And I actually just kind of completed the first phase of that this week, and turned out it was remarkably easy. And I was a little surprised at the ability of the test to perform. I had looked at a number of individuals that were negative, and that's really not that unexpected, because the frequency is still relatively low in the general population. It's about 1 in 2,000 or so. And there's a website that basically has public sequences where people upload their raw DNA files, and it's called OpenSNPs. And that basically it's a searchable database, and it's actually downloadable. So you can identify DNA files that are of interest, and you can download the information. And I took a look at that just to see what kind of frequencies were present in files that had been from 20. Pace, and they had, I think, 824 files that were available there, and I did the search for this one particular frameshift in the BRCA1, and there was really only one positive, you know, it really wasn't that unexpected a number, because, like I say, in the general population, it's about 1 in 2,000 or so. And so there was one positive out of 824. So that indicated that, you know, the 23andMe could detect that, but it was a pretty rare event. And so to see how well it would work in this population, I got one of the cases that was a known positive. In fact, there was only one case that was a known positive. And I got her. She had been diagnosed because she had breast cancer, and she spit in the tube. I went ahead and ran the test and looked at the particular mutation, which, you know, had been identified in a clinical test. And the 23andMe test, you know, gave a positive one. And I thought, well, that's a good start. And then I figured that, well, to trace it, the brother, her brother, had not been tested. And it was clear that it came from her mother. And I could conceivably divide things up as to whether the children got the maternal or the paternal allele from the mother. Uh-huh. And the idea was that if the brother ended up testing negative, I had other family members on the maternal side, and they would end up matching. And that's exactly what happened. So the brother was negative, but the brother matched other family members on the maternal side. And so those two results kind of allowed Tracy to put it on the maternal side. And and then a sister of the mother was tested, and she actually turned out to be positive also. And so that was kind of the third test and the second positive. And so it was clear that it was, you know, working reasonably well, in contrast to this you know, public database where there was only one sample out of 824. In this family, I got two positives out of three samples that were tested. And that was, again, pretty clear cut. But what was interesting was, one of the questions is really, how good is the assay? You're really looking for this one change in the whole protein, you know, which of that change was. And, you know, it says it's positive, but I already had some experience actually looking in the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes for frameshifts and found a very high number in the earlier version, or version 4 from 23andMe. And those results were kind of in the too bad to be true category. I looked at one individual, I looked at BRCA1 and there were 6 frame shifts. I looked at BRCA2 and there were 8 frame shifts. And you know, I looked at that data and said, there is no way that this person's alive. This person should be dead if they really had, even if they had one frame shift in BRCA1 and one in BRCA2, both of those proteins would have been knocked out and they would have had lots of mutations. And if they, you know, they should have developed cancer when they were pretty young. The individual I was looking at wasn't that young.
Those markers don't necessarily absolutely mean you're going to get cancer, correct?
Correct, but it's actually relatively high. I mean, for this is a very well known mutation, and part of the reason it's so well known is because it is a lifetime risk for women for breast cancer, I think, is like 87%. So, you know, almost 9 out of 10 women that have this this defect will end up developing breast cancer. And it's around 40 or 50% for ovarian cancer. So, and some women actually develop both, you know, and not necessarily at the same time.
Excuse me, I got to get this in. Does 23andMe give you these kinds of markers and potentialities to be worried about when you get the results?
Well, no, because these are experimental. Well, let's back up. For the 10 that are FDA approved, those are ones that they've looked at. They know what the false negative and the false positives are. And for you to get that result, number one, you have to kind of do an extra click to say that, yes, you do want to see these results. It's not you're going to get that result and just kind of pop up when you go to the site or your account.
All
so
right.
you and that's part of the FDA approval process. Not only does the test have to be accurate, but they have to have these controls. So you have to, A, ask to see the results, and B, then they go and they give you what your result is, and then they have, you know, details on, you know, what the condition is, and they break it down for different genetic groups as to what their frequencies are and what their risk level is, and they tell you what they're measuring, and then they actually have, you know, other links to if you want to make arrangements to have a genetic counselor to discuss the results, and even sometimes there's support groups that you can go to. So there's all of those types of support opportunities that come along with giving you that type of positive results. But that only applies to these 10 tests And in fact, it's not even 10 because they've got FDA approval on 10. To date, they've given results for 7 of the 10. So for the 7 they've given, they give a lot of information, especially if you're positive, on what you can do about it, and as far as support and counseling and things along those lines. For all the other 600,000, they just have a big, warning at the bottom that you can search your DNA, but this is raw data, and that they can't guarantee the accuracy of it. This is to be used for experimental purposes only, and it's just for information purposes. And that's why it was a bit of a challenge. These markers for BRCA1 and BRCA2 are in this category of experimental. In fact, none of the indications are for cancer predisposition, which was kind of my area of interest. And so that's why I say it was a little bit of a challenge to see if you could take what they would classify as experimental results. And like I said, in the earlier version, there were a whole bunch of BRCA1 and BRCA2 frame shifts in the same individual, which, like I said, were in the too bad to be true category. So it's clear that those weren't real. In version 5, I actually reported them to 23andMe, and they thanked me for that. They said they were going to remove them. And indeed, when they came out with version 5, they were removed.
Uh-huh.
So those were some of the changes. And actually, I found similar results in other fairly well-known regulatory genes that had a bunch of frame shifts. And in version 5, they actually removed those also. And so that's part of the reason I kind of undertook this project, was to see if this newer version could be used to take this one condition, which is very well known and has serious consequences, but it was not on the approved list, and see whether how it would perform and how you could get verification on it. And I know we're running out of time, but just to wrap up, it really was kind of accomplished with just the first 4 individuals. And it turned out the 2 of them were positive, one of which had a clinical test and confirmed it. And then 2 of them were negative. And they really matched each other. The 2 that were negative had an identical BRCA1 sequence, and the 2 that were positive had an identical sequence. And one came from one of the alleles of the mother, and the other one came from the other allele. And what made it particularly interesting is the one that was, the 4th one that I mentioned, turned out that she was negative, but she had been told by her doctor that she was positive and that she had the same mutation that her niece had. And I looked at the data and I said, I don't know, I think you need to check out that clinical test because it's really pretty straightforward. And you match, the brother who was negative, and you have the identical sequence, and you test the negative in the test, and so I called her up and said, well, what exactly did you see the test? And she said, no, I didn't see the test. The doctor just gave me the results over the phone. And I said, well, I think you really need to get a copy of that test.
Yeah, it'd be a good idea. You got to wrap it up, Henry. Hurry up.
She got the test, and the test said she was negative. And then it turned out that she had given the doctor her niece's results. And I'm almost positive that her niece's results was in her file. And he went and he used that to figure out what test to run. And then when he went and got the test, he actually was reading her niece's results. And sure enough, it was positive. And sure enough, it was the identical mutation that the niece had because he was reading the niece's file. That's a quick little story, but that is one of the applications of these tests.
Okay.
And,
all right.
It's Henry, more along those lines.
Thank you for the update. Always a lot of knowledge in that hour. We appreciate it. You stay well, and we'll talk to you next month.
Okay, sounds good. You too. Take care.
Be good. Okay, we're running a little late. Let's jump into the break and jump right back out. Christopher Dunn is up next, and we have some amazing pictures to look at.